From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Neil Diamond started his career writing songs for other singers, but he wasn't getting many takers. He ended up making his own songs famous. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Diamond about some of his early records like Solitary Man and Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon. And we'll talk about his new record, 12 Songs. It features 12 new songs with stripped-down accompaniment produced by Rick Rubin, who also produced Johnny Cash's final albums. Also, Bar Mitzvah Disco. We talk with the authors of a new book that collects pictures from Bar Mitzvah albums of the 80s. It's a world they describe as part Fantasy Island and part Vegas, where everyone is dancing to the Village People. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Neil Diamond started out writing songs for a music publishing company in the hopes that someone would record them. He wrote the Monkees' number one hit, I'm a Believer. But it was Diamond himself who made most of his own songs famous. Songs like Solitary Man, Cherry Cherry, Girl You'll Be a Woman Soon, and Sweet Caroline. As a lot of his contemporaries fell off the charts, he moved from teen pop to adult pop. He recorded a duet with Barbra Streisand, had hits from his remake of The Jazz Singer, and dressed in spangles for his sold-out concerts. Now he has a new CD that is intentionally unglitzy. It's an album of new songs produced by Rick Rubin, who recorded Johnny Cash's musically and emotionally naked final albums. Before we hear from Diamond, here's a track from his new CD, 12 songs. Brian Wilson makes a special appearance doing the harmonies.
Pretty soon we were taking it serious. Me and you underneath a mysterious spell. Nothing I could do, and it suddenly felt like a bolt out of hell. I'm telling you, to the sound of the beat I was hanging on. Like a powerful truth, it was banging on me. Wouldn't let me go. Like a shot in the dark, she was hot like a spark. I only know neither one of us trying to hold it down. One of us taking the middle ground. Wasn't how to make sense we were thinking of. Just the two of us bent on delirious love. Me and you being spent on delirious love. Like a ride on a rocket, it took us up.
That's Neil Diamond from his new CD, 12 Songs. Neil Diamond, welcome to Fresh Air. How did
you
and
much.
Rick Rubin get together and decide to collaborate on this new CD?
Well, you know, Rick is a highly regarded presence in the music business, and I've always been curious about him, but I never thought that I'd work with him. It seemed that he was more into heavier rock. He did a number of rap records, and just more recently did the Johnny Cash anthology, and I didn't see where I fit into that. But we met, we finally connected up, we met, we talked, and I realized we weren't as far apart as I thought we might be, and that he had a pretty good beat on what he wanted from an album with me. But there was no telling, you know, write this kind of stuff or write that kind of stuff. It was just write the best you can, and let's listen to it and see if I can see a record in there.
But I imagine he wanted the instrumentation more stripped down.
Well, yes, the instrumentation was bare and sparse and stripped down. That's something he did want after we worked together for a while. It became clear to him, I think, that this would be a very basic, cut to the bone album of my songs.
Neil Diamond, when you're writing for yourself, as you've gotten older, do you write a different kind of song? I mean, you started writing songs when you were a teenager, and that was in the 60s. So do you think that the songs you write have changed as you've gotten older and experienced more, and you're not a teenager?
Yeah, I have to say that they have changed, certainly from the beginning, because the early songs were all teenage laments and meant for that age group somehow, because that was the audience at that time for a single artist, and especially a guy with a guitar. But over the years, you grow up, you mature, you see things in a different way, and it's reflected in the writing. So, I mean, at this point, my writing is different. I think it's better. I think it's deeper. But it's, strangely enough, it covers a lot of the old ground. Maybe it says it in a better way, a more sophisticated way, but it's that old thing, I write a lot about relationships, and I did that at the beginning, too. Maybe immature and kind of rough around the edges when I first started, but they're basically the same subject over the last years.
I think it's fair to say your first big break, correct me if I'm wrong, was when you had recorded a demo, and the songwriters Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry heard the demo and they really liked you. And they, some of their songs are Do Run Run, Chapel of Love.
Be My Baby.
Be My Baby, yeah. So how did they hear you?
I was making a demo. Usually when you sold a song to a publisher, they would allow you to go in and make your own demo, which was invaluable experience to me. But I went and made the demo and hired Ellie as a backup singer, which she did, despite the fact that she was having huge hits. She liked to sing in the studios with the other girls, and so I hired her for this session, and she liked something about what I was doing, my writing or my singing, and she brought me to her husband, Jeff, and he liked something about what I was doing. I don't know if he liked the writing or the singing, but one liked one, and the other one liked the other, so we started a working relationship. We were both working for the same music publisher, and I kind of got let go by that music publisher, and I asked Jeff and Ellie if they were interested in producing me.
In the first session that you did with them, you recorded Solitary Man. Did you like the idea of horns on this?
I like the idea of anything on those records. I was just thrilled to be there.
Well, let's hear Solitary Man, which I have to say, I think it's really a terrific recording.
Thank you.
Yeah, so, okay, let's hear it. This is your first hit, yes?
Yes,
you recorded yourself.
Hit.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is Neil Diamond, Solitary Man.
The Linda was mine till the time that I found her holding Jim, loving him. Then Sue came along, loved me strong. That's what I thought, me and Sue, but I do. Don't know that I will, but until I can find me a girl to stay and won't play games behind me, then I'll be what I am, a solid.
Neil Diamond. Now, did you write this song for yourself or for somebody else?
No, I wrote this for myself. I had a contract with Jeff and Ellie, and I started to focus in on just what I wanted to do. And so Solitary Man was written for me and for the first sessions that I was to do with Jeff and Ellie.
There's this like urgency in the song and in the way you sing it. And I think of you in a way as kind of specializing in some of your work in that urgency. Some of the music on your new CD, 12 Songs, too, has that just really urgent sound to it. Is that something you've been conscious of that you think really like works especially well for you as a songwriter and as a singer?
Well, I can tell you that I wasn't conscious of it until you just mentioned it. I've never thought of my songs having that sense of urgency, but I'll listen again and maybe as an objective observer you can pick up on that stuff, but I never felt that there was an urgency, a sense of drama, a sense of yearning, lots of things, but not urgency. But you may be very right about this. I'm going to listen again now.
So how did Solitary Man change your idea of what you wanted from your musical life?
Once I had a chart record of my own, I was no longer a kid knocking around on the streets. I was now, we didn't call them artists at that time. We called them vocalists, but I was a vocalist. And it was a whole different thing. I was writing for myself, so I had to really dig in and write as well as I possibly could, And I have to say, before that time, I don't know if I was doing that. I was just writing and writing and writing, maybe just to get an advance from a publisher. But there was not a lot of me in those songs. And Solitary Man was the first of a long line of me songs, my experience songs.
When you were working in the Rock and Roll Tin Pan Alley, were you actually, and you were writing for music publishers, were you actually going to an office building every day to write?
When I was signed to a staff publishing company, a music company, I would go in as often as I possibly could. The subway train from Brighton Beach, where I lived, that took us to New York University, went also a few more stops further to Tin Pan Alley. So there was a lot of cutting of classes, going up and trying to peddle the newest song, probably that I had written in one of the classes at school. And so it was an attraction. It was a seduction that was just a couple of stops beyond NYU. And I unfortunately spent a lot of time skipping that the NYU 8th Street stop and going up to the 49th Street stop, which is where Tin Pan Alley was. And that was great fun, too.
Now, were these several buildings? Was it just the Brill Building or 1620 Broadway also?
Well, 1650 Broadway.
1650, yeah, sorry, yeah.
That's all right. Yes, the Brill Building, but there were dozens and maybe hundreds of other music publishing companies in that area in all kinds of buildings. It was that era when rock and roll had just come in, and anybody could get a listening to their music because the publishers didn't understand what rock and roll was, and they were willing to listen to anybody and sign anybody that they thought might have the vaguest chance of having some success. So it was an open game for a number of years. But then things got serious. I got married. I was having a baby on the way, and I had to get serious. Enough with this fun.
When you were working as a songwriter for publishers, writing for other people, were you writing for specific people? Were you writing with specific singers in mind?
Well, that's usually how it went back then, although I was never a good enough writer to kind of write for some other singer to understand what they did best, the keys, the kind of song. Usually you were told that so-and-so is coming up for a session in 3 weeks and they need a song of this type, and it was usually as close as possible to the song that they had previously, which was a hit, if it was a hit. And you had to write a kind of like a copy of that in a way. Because that's the way it worked in those days. You have a hit record, and your next record should sound as much like the hit record as you can make it. But I wasn't very good at it. That's probably why I spent 8 years down there in Tin Pan Alley and had very little success. Nothing more really than selling a song and taking a small advance for it to get me through the week.
Now, the Monkees did a couple of your songs, I'm a Believer and A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You. Did you write those with them in mind or for yourself? I'm trying to think of what the chronology was. Like, you start recording in, what, like 67?
66.
66, okay. And what year are the Monkees? Like, is that after that?
I think 67, something like that. I had recorded a couple of songs, including Solitary Man and Cherry Cherry, which was a big hit. And because of that hit, the people who were producing the Monkees called and said, we like Cherry Cherry. Do you have any other songs? I said, well, I don't have anything like Cherry Cherry, but I have an album coming out soon, and I'll send it over and take your pick.
You know, it's funny. The common wisdom goes when telling the story of, like, songwriters from the Brill Building and the Beatles is that the Beatles changed everything. After the Beatles, bands started writing their own songs. It drove out the professional songwriters. But, of course, the Monkees are a band that's, you know, a kind of fabricated band copying the Beatles. and you have this tremendous success writing for them. And in that sense, like, the Beatles' success inadvertently really helped you as a songwriter.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. But it was not only in the sense of the Monkees doing a couple of songs. It was in the sense that the doors began to open for songwriters who were able to sing. And I just happened to be one of them who'd been knocking around the streets for years and now suddenly was getting a new and fresh listening to my work. So the Beatles made an enormous change, as did Bob Dylan. They brought the songwriter up to the front of the line and said, you know, you guys do it. And it had a devastating effect on the music publishing business in Tin Pan Alley, but it opened up many doors for people like me.
My guest is Neil Diamond. Here's his version of I'm a Believer.
I thought love was only true in fairy tale, meant for someone else but not for me. Love pointing on, get all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer, not a dream. Doubt my mind, I'm in love. And I'm a believer, I couldn't leave her if I tried.
We'll talk more with Neil Diamond after a break. This is Fresh Air. Neil Diamond is my guest, and his new CD is called 12 Songs, and it's produced by Rick Rubin. One of the things you've done is, you start in the movie, the jazz singer, and it was a kind of updated, new interpretation of the Al Jolson movie.
Right.
In this movie, you're a rock singer, but your father's a cantor, and he wants you to lead the more traditional life and to sing the more traditional material, and you're of course doing neither. And he acts as if he's in mourning, and he's completely lost his son. And of course, you wrote all the songs for it too. Now, your father wasn't a cantor, but he did,
no,
from what I understand, listen to a lot of Yiddish recordings. Did he listen to cantorial records as well?
No, never any cantorial music. He listened to, lip sync for charities around Brooklyn, and he listened to operatic records, including Yiddish records, and he did lip sync and mime to those records. But there was always music playing in his shop. The radio was always on, so I became pretty familiar with all the top 40 records. They danced. My parents were very big ballroom dancers, so that music was around. They got into Latin music for a while, so that music was around, and I learned to dance that way. A lot of it ran off from my parents to me until I was able to start my own little thing. I bumped into folk music when I was about 15, and that made me want to get a guitar. And so at the beginning, I played only folk music, the folk music that you play at camp around the fireplace. And it developed from there.
You know, my theory is that the music that you hear when you're young imprints itself in your mind and forms like your basic vocabulary of musical sounds and of melody and harmony. So do you think that music affected your own songwriting eventually?
I think it did. I think it had some influence on the kind of songs I wrote and maybe even the melodies, because the melodies of some of those early Yiddish things are so strong that they do imprint on your brain. But I must say that more than that, my experiences at camp and playing the guitar and wanting to play folk music and wanting to meet the girls had a much stronger influence on my decisions to go ahead and make this my life's work.
So what were the songs you sang at camp?
Well, we sang all of Woody Guthrie's songs. We sang a lot of the Weavers. Not so much Hank Williams. I think I got into Hank Williams a little bit later. But it was mostly the folk songs of that period, Pete Seeger. That type of music was what I kind of started with.
Neil Diamond has a new CD called 12 Songs. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Have we come this far to have gone astray? I've been lost before, but not lost this way. You and me thought we'd be evermore. Do I know you? Did I ever thought I did? Now I know better. Saw the signs, but not the danger. How'd you get to be a stranger?
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, an African-American Testament, part of Barnes & Noble Classics, available in stores and online. From Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from Universal Pictures, presenting Munich, directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Eric Bana, Daniel Craig, and Jeffrey Rush, in select cities December 23rd. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Girl, you'll be a woman soon.
Coming up, Neil Diamond on his song that ended up in Pulp Fiction. Also, Bar Mitzvah Disco. We talk with the authors of a new book collecting photograph albums from 80s Bar Mitzvahs.
They'll never get tired of putting me down, and I never know when I come around what I'm gonna find. Don't let them break up your mind. Don't you know, girl, you'll be a woman soon. Please come take my
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Neil Diamond. He has a new CD called 12 Songs that features 12 new songs. The CD is produced by Rick Rubin, who also produced Johnny Cash's final albums. I want to ask you about another of your songs, and this is also an earlier song. It's Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, and the Urge Overkill version of this was used by Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction. Can you tell us the story behind the song?
Oh, behind the song was pretty basic. I was playing mostly to teenagers, teenage girls, when I first started. Going through that period, I just wrote a song for the audience to do, for me to do in the show, and for the audience, which was, as I say, teenage girls. And Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon was something I wrote for them, and I recorded it myself.
How did you find out that Quentin Tarantino was going to use a version of this song for Pulp Fiction?
Well, first they have to request the right to use it. There's no general license for that. Each one has to be requested and negotiated and either agreed or not agreed on. But I got a request and a part of a script to be used in this movie called Pulp Fiction. And I've always held to a very tenuous line as to what I wanted my songs to be used as. And I wouldn't let them be used in cigarette commercials or alcohol commercials. And the script that I read was way out there. It was, you know, beyond what I would turn down normally, and I did turn it down. I heard almost immediately from my publisher, who said, you know, you shouldn't turn this down. This guy's a tremendous director, and you should just do it and let them do it, which I did. And, of course, I've never regretted it, because it was an entirely different way of seeing that song. But that's basically how it happened.
So what'd you think of the movie?
Oh, I love the movie. I was amazed by the movie. I've seen it.
How come you love the movie but didn't love the script? What was different actually seeing it?
Well, I didn't get the whole script. I only got a few pages of the script in which the song would be used. And I don't know if you remember the scene, but she was, Uma Thurman was very heavily into a coke binge, and she went unconscious and had to be taken for some quote-unquote special treatment. You know, it just seemed too strong for my own taste, and I turned it down on that basis.
Well, here's a song you wrote to please your teenage fans, and now it's going to be used in an overdose scene, in a drug overdose scene. Not what you had in mind.
Not at all, but I would have reacted the same to any of the other songs I had written.
Mm-hmm. But it was very effective in the film.
It was very effective, and it was a lesson that I learned, you know. See who else is working on it. See how serious they are. Don't take it at face value, and don't take your prejudices into this kind of discussion.
Well, why don't we hear your version of the song? Here it is.
Great.
Girl, you'll be a woman soon. Love you so much, can't count all the ways I'd die for you, girl, and all they can say is, isn't that your kind? They never get tired of putting me down, and I never know when I come around what I'm gonna find. Don't let them make up your mind. Don't you know, girl, you'll be a woman soon. Please come take my
Neil Diamond, one of his earlier hits, and he has a new CD called 12 Songs. One of the things that has kept you musically successful over the decades is your tours. Would you describe a little bit how you put together your idea of what a show should be?
It's a good question. I've never worked with a director. I like to put the shows together myself with the help of a lot of other people, including the band, my band, who've been with me for many years. And we start right at the beginning. I have a huge blackboard in the studio, and we start with the songs that I want to include and that we haven't included in previous shows. I try to find a good opening song, a good closing song, which is usually, traditionally for me, has been Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show, because it kind of sums up what I'm about and what I'd like the world to be about. And you fill in and you try to make something interesting, and each song has to have something that's new and fresh and original about it, even if it was written 30 years ago.
What about figuring out what to wear for your shows?
I never thought about it. I have a clothing designer. His name is Bill Whitten. He's been doing my stage clothes for 35 years now. And so I let Bill take the lead in that. I have comments, obviously, things I like and don't like. But Bill handles that, and I think he decided in the mid-70s that he wanted to go with glass beading and sparkly kind of things, basically, I think, because no one else was using it, and it would become mine. So, okay, I tried it, and I think it worked very well, although it's become a point of contention. I mean, just the fact that you bring it up is what has been happening over the years. I'll get a review for a show, and they'll think the show is wonderful, but they'll put down the shirt, which is terrific. I'd rather have them put down the shirt than something important. But I've been wearing those kind of shirts, and now it's tapering off now. But the shirts have been part of my persona on stage for as long as I can remember.
I want to ask you about another song that you wrote and recorded, a big hit for you, Sweet Caroline, which is now played at Red Sox games at Fenway Park, and maybe you know the story of why of why that is. But let's start with the song itself. Is there a story behind the writing of the song?
Yeah, I think so. I was heading down to Memphis for my first recording session down there, and there were some producers I wanted to work with, and I only had two songs written, and in those days a session was 3 hours, and you usually had three songs that you recorded. So the night before the session at some motel in Memphis, I knocked out this song, Sweet Caroline. It was one of the fastest songs I've ever written, and we recorded it the next day, and it became one of my biggest songs, if not the biggest song. But songs usually don't come like that. There's usually a lot of work and teeth gnashing and agony and torment over any of these songs. But that one just popped out, and there it was, and here it is now. Still, people can sing it.
It's also sung a lot in bars.
Well, the fact is that it's fun and easy to sing with, and I think that that's the bottom line as far as that song is concerned. It's easy to sing. It's fun. People like to sing it. And that's why it's popular in bars, because anybody can sing it, no matter how many drinks you've had.
Well, Neil Diamond, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry.
Where it began, I can't begin to knowing, but then I know it's growing strong. Wasn't the spring, and spring became the summer. Who'd have believed you'd come along? Hands, touching hands, reaching out, touching me, touching you. Now
That's Sweet Caroline. Neil Diamond has a new CD called 12 Songs. Coming up, Bar Mitzvah Disco. This is Fresh Air. Perhaps we'll never know the answer to why the anthem of so many bar mitzvahs in the 80s was the Village People's YMCA. But this is the kind of phenomenon that's explored in the new book Bar Mitzvah Disco. It's all about bar mitzvahs from the late 70s to the early 90s, and it features many photos from bar mitzvah albums of the era. The authors had their bar mitzvahs in this period, and they described some of the parties as two parts Fantasy Island, one part Vegas. The bar and bat mitzvah are Jewish ceremonies that celebrate a young person's passage into adulthood at the age of 13. What fascinates the authors are the parties that follow the religious ceremony, particularly the extravagant catered affairs that became popular in the suburbs. My guests are Roger Bennett, Jules Schell, and Nick Kroll. Kroll is a comic and has been a contributing writer to Chappelle's Show. Bennett and Schell are part of the Reboot Network, a company trying to explore Jewish identity through music, film, discussions, and a new quarterly journal called Guilt and Pleasure. What are some of the things that you think make the 80s bar mitzvah unique and distinct from bar mitzvahs of every other decade?
It really became the apex of when bar mitzvahs began to change to the sort of a me generation vibe, where lots more money was being spent. Themes started to pop up, and the themes to us represent what is again a look at pop culture. So you had people with California Raisins costumes on running around, and you know, Van Halen cakes, and with the Police Synchronicity album below it. I mean, just sort of these bizarre manifestations together that really speak to us about what American culture was in the 80s.
I think also the reality is that the 70s and the 80s, which is a time the book really spans, is a time when bar and bat mitzvahs stopped being by Jews, for Jews, with Jews alone. But kind of we moved to the suburbs, we were in the mix. And if you were a non-Jew in a suburban city, you had one golden year where you were going to bar and bat mitzvahs almost every weekend.
I'm going to ask you to go around the table and each take 60 seconds to describe your bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. And if it had a theme, you need to tell us what the theme was.
I'll start.
Okay.
I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, and had a bat mitzvah in 1991. And this is the first time ever in public that I'm announcing what my theme was. It was actually a gambling casino theme because my birth date is 7/7/70. Terry, you're laughing. 7/7/77. And so my mother thought, lucky seven, and hired all of my sister's friends to run the casinos. And I think back at that and thought, what the hell were they doing?
What a perfect theme for a spiritual occasion such as, you know,
what can
a
I
religious
say,
rite of passage, gambling casino. It's perfect.
What can I say? All of the ritual elements of ritual were there, but the casino theme really took the cake.
And Nick, what was your theme?
I was also bar mitzvahed in 1991, and my theme was I had a world theme. So basically, I had flags hanging down from the center in the dance floor and globes on each table, inflatable globes and pocket atlases as the table cards. So you'd come to the front and you'd see Terry Gross and you'd say, open up to page 83. You saw Venezuela. That would be the table you were at. I had a miserable time at my bar mitzvah. For various reasons. I think the main thing was that I was sort of part of, very much involved in the planning process of the party with my mom. And so I when I actually got to the party, I didn't begin to relax in any way because I still felt like I was planning the party, worrying about when the pigs in a blanket were coming out. And I think that was my first step into adulthood, which was sort of a sad moment for me.
From which he's never really recovered.
No, that's the truth.
But my bar mitzvah was in Liverpool, and it was in the beginning of the 80s, and Liverpool was a very musical city. Echo and the Bunnymen were huge. The band The Teardrop Explodes were coming through. And 11, 12 years of age, almost every week, I'd say to my mum, could I dye my hair now, please? She'd be like, no. Can I dye my hair now, please? She'd be like, no. So come the bar mitzvah, and you're king for the day. I decided I would have a punk-themed bar mitzvah solely so I could have the opportunity to dye my hair, which I did blue for the occasion. And, I mean, it sounds remarkable. It sounds very punk. But the reality was I had a pair of glasses, which were the same ones as my favorite comedian of the day, Ben Elton, wore. He happened to be like a 6'3" gentleman. I was a 5'1" little boy. And if you look in the introduction, I've had everybody phone me up and say, what was your parents thinking that on your bar and bat mitzvah photographs, you were literally wearing a pair of women's spectacles, which is pretty much the case. So I was a young boy pretending to be a man wearing a pair of women's spectacles with blue hair. It was very deep.
And was it punk music only that was played at your bar mitzvah?
I think it was a mix of punk concerts probably across the country. They always throw in a couple of klezmer tunes, and my bar mitzvah was no different.
So, you know, the music is so key at a bar or bat mitzvah, and whether there's going to be records, you know, or a band. So when you were putting together your book, what did you find was basically in the top 10 of bar mitzvah songs from the period of the 80s and shortly before and after?
The YMCA by the Village People is the most important song to hit the Jewish religion since Havan Gila.
And Madonna Vogue is on here, which leads us to one of my favorite parts of the book, which is Sean Sperling's bar mitzvah, a gentleman from Chicago, and he had a Madonna-themed bar mitzvah, including Madonna airbrushed onto the back of his dress shirt. And there's a picture of him voguing, which he went over and over with his sister beforehand.
Your book is filled with pictures from other people's bar mitzvah albums, the photographs from their albums. And there are obviously a few shots that became like the standard bar mitzvah photo shots. And mm-hmm. Jules, what are some of those poses that everybody seems to have in their album?
Well, I just back up and say that oftentimes these albums came with a note, and the note would say, here are my photographs. There's nothing special here. Use as much as you want. We love the project. And then people would send in albums with awkward teens riding into their bat mitzvah on the back of an elephant. That was Stephanie Huttner from Denver. There was Michelle Shapiro posing at the end of the album in the back of her photographer's Corvette. There was Mike Epstein in front of a mariachi band at his Latino-themed bar mitzvah. So we really got an array of fabulous and wonderful photographs.
And what were some of the standard poses that everybody, no matter what their theme was, seemed to have in their album?
A couple favorites are, of course, there's the wave goodbye, which is at the end of every album. And one of the great things about the wave goodbye picture is about half of the people who sent that picture in said, I think we took this picture about halfway through or the beginning of the evening, the wave goodbye, and, you know, just sort of lending to the the bizarreness of the event. But then there's seems that a lot of bar mitzvah photographers never met a double exposure that they couldn't and wouldn't fall in love with. And there's a bunch of those. One classic is the boy dreaming, and that with a double exposure of him being kissed on each cheek by two girls.
One of the standard shots I feel like we have to pay homage to here is the shot where the bar mitzvah boy or girl is standing, and there's a portrait of them, but behind them, in this like double exposure, behind them is a silhouette of their profile. So they're standing in a silhouette of their own mm-hmm. profile. And that turns up in everyone's bar mitzvah album, don't you think?
Yes, it's in every, there's some great shots of the double exposure, but the double exposure shot is a key. It shows them inside their own head, so to speak. Okay.
You write in the book, the bar mitzvah experience is so much more than a celebration of one young person's passage into adulthood. It's also about the family they were embarrassed to be a part of. And do you feel like you see that embarrassment in some photos, that the kid looks really embarrassed in the kind of setting that they're in?
At that time in general, and these pictures capture that, there's just an awkwardness to life for many people. Some individuals at 13 were literally, and you can see this in the book, they look like they're 22, and good on them. But let's be honest, many of them look like they're about 7 or 8 and are barely out of kindergarten. And in those days, you are dealing with your the feelings you have inside your own mind. You also have the kind of the power of the peer group and how that impacts you. And you're also dealing with your respective crushes. And to throw your family in the mix, having to bring all of these things together, your family, your friends, the people you want to be your friends, the people you wish were in your life. I mean, it was really an emotionally very complicated time for many of the readers to navigate from their comments.
My guests are the authors of the new book, Bar Mitzvah Disco. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are the authors of the new book, Bar Mitzvah Disco, Roger Bennett, Jules Schell, and Nick Kroll. We've been laughing a lot about the Bar Mitzvah themes and the photograph albums and the Village People music that was played there. We haven't talked at all about the religion or the religious significance of the Bar Mitzvah. And I'm wondering if you felt connected to any of that while planning the party or while actually having the party. Did the larger, you know, sense that this is a genuine religious ritual enter much into the equation for you?
Well, I can answer that personally and say I want to know where my Russian twin is. I had a Russian twin named Irina Kislova, and I always wondered what happened to her. And I remember in the announcement that went out in the newspaper that I was being bat mitzvahed, there was some line about me having a Soviet twin and my hope that I would understand that she may come to understand and appreciate her Jewish heritage. And I can't understand. I didn't know if I understood my own Jewish heritage. So to have that responsibility for my Russian twin was quite funny at that age. And I always wonder what happened to her. Where is she now?
So the whole idea of the Russian twin was that you were matched up with a young Jewish girl in the Soviet Union who wasn't allowed to practice her religion?
Correct.
Right. There's a lot of people have that, including Brett Gelman, who's a comedian in New York. And ironically, his theme at his bar mitzvah was Late Night with Brett Gelman, which is the invitation was a big poster of Brett in a tails and a top hat. And it's Late Night with Brett Gelman. And it goes through this whole thing like Grandma says he's a class act and things like that. But then at the bottom, this very sort of large, grandiose invitation is at the bottom is Brett Gelman will be sharing his bar mitzvah experience with a Russian boy and an Ethiopian boy. And it's a very interesting paradox of this great level of, like, let's celebrate the comedy of Brett Gelman with a very, very austere quote in the bottom about his connection to the Ethiopian Russian boy.
When you were 13 and a lot of your friends were having bar mitzvahs, was there this sense of needing to outdo each other? And were people judged by whether they had a good party or not, whether the party was cool or not? I mean, did it really affect your social status in school?
Well, I will say one of the things that we continue to hear was people saying, on both sides of it, either I had a bar mitzvah early in the season, what was called the bar mitzvah season, let's say, like the circuit. And either that was great because you could establish the level of the playing field, or if you were ended up at the end of the year, it meant you had even more to overcome because at that point kids had seen everything. So after going to a bunch of Pee Wee Studio 54s, it's tough to overcome that, and you know, it's not the but so there is a level of competition there, I think, at times there was.
But the bar mitzvah also gave the star of the show some real power and some real say and sway socially, even if it was only for one day. And the table shots were a great classic, almost two-thirds of the way through every album, where the bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah kid is sitting with their friends around the table smiling happily. Again, the comments came in that people would say, none of these people were actually my friends. My friends were sitting on table 12. These were the people I'd longed to be with for the past kind of decade of school. They were the football players, or they were the cool kids, or they were, in some cases, I guess, Dungeons and Dragons players, depending on the kid. But like literally, you were in control, and for that one day, your friends could be whoever you wanted to be. And that seemed to be very much a universal theme.
Thank you all very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much, Terry.
Thanks for having us home.
Roger Bennett, Jules Schell, and Nick Kroll are the authors of Bar Mitzvah Disco. You can find pictures from it on our website, freshair.npr.org.
Young man, there's no need to feel down. I said, young man, pick yourself off the ground. I said, young man.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Genny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. They have everything for your men to enjoy. You can hang out with all the boys. It's fun to stay at the YMCA.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from WorkSong, Rhino, and Starbucks, presenting I Believe to My Soul, a CD featuring five soul artists. Information at starbucks.com/hearmusic. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Misquoting Jesus. We talk with biblical scholar Bart Ehrman. His new book explores how the Gospels were changed by scribes through a combination of mistakes and intentional revisions. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.